Hello, everyone. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker, my running mate, and I ran on. So I just have a couple comments. I've just come out of a New York State Green Party State Committee meeting and, didn't prepare a lot of remarks. But I think, one, I got asked about it last week, what I thought about the possible railroad strike. And, I looked into it some more, talked to some rail workers that I know. And, the big issue, which was not addressed in this tentative agreement, is the shift scheduling. These guys are on 24/7 call, and they have to be ready to go to work in 2 hours. And a lot of times they get called at the last minute. They can't plan their lives around that. And there was some give by the railroad companies with respect to taking sick days. And I think they got some extra sick days, but apparently this scheduling issue, and there's this point system around it. If you don't respond to the call, you get deducted points, and you get a certain number of points deducted, you can be suspended the first time and suspended more the second time and third time terminated. It just makes these guys' lives and women lives miserable, because they got to sit there with their cell phone, whatever they're doing, because they got to respond within 2 hours or get to work within 2 hours. So that was a big issue. And apparently it was not resolved from what I've been able to read. So, there was a tentative agreement between the negotiators for the union and the companies, but the workers got a vote to ratify, and that's not going to be done until mid-October. So there may yet be a rail strike. We'll see what the workers think about the agreement. And they got to calculate a number of things, because the way negotiations go in the rail industry, it's very regulated. There was a law passed 1991 by a vote of 400-5 in Congress, in the House, that really restricts the right of rail workers to strike. And there has to be a cooling off period, and and Congress can step in. And what their workers got to worry about is that the Republicans take back control of Congress, and then they have to step in because there's an impasse in negotiations because the contract was voted in. Republicans could really screw the workers. So that may give them motivation to, ratify what they got, fearing they might get worse if it ends up in Congress hands. So there's a lot of things at play here. But, just the fact that these guys and women have to, be on call all the time and go to work within 2 hours and then work long shifts, sometimes 7 days in a row, it's just not the way work life should be. So these workers have real issues, and I'm not sure they were resolved. So we'll have to see. I think the other thing that I think we need to pay attention to is this bill that was the side deal to the Build Back Badly bill that Manchin got through, also known as the Inflation Reduction Act. And the side deal was to ease permitting. Now, the reality is permitting for, whether it's oil and gas or renewables or any kind of construction takes a long time where you need federal approvals, because the people doing the review of the projects and the approvals, they're understaffed and underfinanced. If we want to speed up these things, we need to provide, the number of federal staff to do the work. That's the big obstacle. And instead, what the Manchin bill is supposedly going to do is just take away the ability of interested parties, particularly citizens, environmentalists, and so forth, to intervene and state their concerns about certain projects and just railroad it past the public. And that will create, projects that shouldn't be built. That is not a solution to the timing issue of getting things permitted in a timely way and get these projects going where they should be done. It's a matter of staffing these agencies. So, it's going after the wrong target. It's part of this whole neoliberal deregulate, let the corporations run the show. And now the thing is, we haven't even yet seen the Manchin bill. The only thing we've seen is a early draft from July that had the Petroleum Institute as a watermark on the paper this bill was written on, which means, Petroleum Institute wrote it. And whether that's what's actually going to be put forward, we'll have to see. But certainly the industry had an interest. It's like Obamacare was written by the insurance industry. That's the problem we've got. A lot of these bills come forward and, you know, it's these well-paid lobbyists on behalf of wealthy trade groups. So we still haven't seen the bill. There does seem to be some substantial opposition from progressives in the House. And to the point where Hoyer and Schumer have indicated maybe it won't be attached to the continuing resolution, which is funding the government. And a lot of garbage gets through because people don't want to see the government shut down. So they hold their nose and vote for the continuing resolution when there are bills like this permitting issue that are bill attached to it. But apparently that may be separated, which gives us a better fighting chance to defeat it. So that's something to keep an eye on. And it's going to play out pretty quickly here is because they want to get this done in the next couple of weeks so they can spend October running for re-election. So like that's pretty much what's been in the news besides the, you know, the death of Queen Elizabeth and the new king. What's his name? Charles? I'm not sure. You know, I'm not into monarchies, but the news is, and I haven't been watching much of the news. So I'll leave that issue at that. Maybe you'll want to comment on that. So, you know, I'm looking forward to your comments and questions. Mr. Anderson, if they pass the bill that the gold mine they wanted to open in Alaska may get approved, which will put in danger the fishing in that area, if I'm remembering correctly. So the permitting bill will allow a gold mine to go through that endangers a fishing area. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that Manchin wants permitted because he's for industry. By the way, I saw a poll that said Manchin's approval rating right now in West Virginia is 25%. And I expect that's partly because, you know, the Trump MAGA crowd isn't going to vote for any Democrat. But I think it's also because the Democrats who tend to be progressive don't like Manchin either. So this, whatever I saw said, you know, he may be angling with Biden to get an ambassadorship before the next election comes around for him. So anyway, yeah, Manchin, I wouldn't vote for him. So anyway, yeah, that's the kind of thing that will be permitted. And then mining, that's another thing. You know, we let mining companies extract these minerals with minimal royalties to the public. This is our, you know, common inheritance. Nobody made that gold or whatever the mineral is. It's something that is out there in nature. It's really our common inheritance, should be common property. Or if a private company mines it to sell it in the market, they should pay royalties to the public. And I forget what the amount is, but we're going on, I think, an 1872 mining law that, you know, they pay like $5 for the permit and really low levels of royalties. So I can't remember the details, but basically the mining companies are getting away with stealing our common inheritance, which is another issue that I know Ralph Nader was raising when he ran, you know, 22 years ago now and 26 years ago and 18 years ago. I mean, he'd always bring up that Mining Act, and it's one of those things that Congress hasn't even bothered looking at. They're dealing with the law going back to the 1800s, the Gilded Age, when, you know, the corporations really began to take control of government and really haven't addressed it. San Musto, question, as a Christian, I sometimes feel unwelcome and in the minority in the Green Party, which has plenty of atheist followers. How can the party be more welcoming to people of all faiths and atheists and agnostics, etc., and put aside religious differences to unite and really get the Green Socialist Movement on the map and as a welcoming and tolerant party? I feel like many would-be Greens are turned away from the party because of this. Well, I'm not aware of people, you know, being denigrated because they're Christian. I mean, I'm an atheist philosophically, but I'm a Christian morally. I mean, Christ was a Jesus Christ was a he was a working class anti-imperialist revolutionary in terms of what he was doing. And, you know, the ethics that he put forward, you know, basically the golden rule, you know, is what, you know, a socialist movement should be about. So I would like to know more specifically where that issue is or where it's coming from, because I really haven't seen it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and it shouldn't exist. The Greens should be open to people of all faiths or no faith. And it's really, you know, we believe in separation of church and state in terms of our constitution, so that it's really a free speech issue. And we should have the same thing within the party, you know, separate religion and politics and let people's, you know, religious faiths and practices, you know, let them do them without any negative aspersions toward it. Andy Messick, speaking of the news, how do you normally get around those who follow news sources that are sponsored by defense contractors and other big money interests? Well, I get my news from, you know, every source. It includes, you know, the mainstream media, where the defense, the military industrial complex has a lot of influence, a lot of bias, even placing their people as commentators, you know, on the cable news and major networks. And also as people who have, it seems, easier access to the pages of the opinion op-ed pages than somebody like me or you. So, you know, that's a problem. On the other hand, they do have big staffs with reporters out there. And I think the reporters, for the most part, you know, they try to do, you know, they're good journalists that try to report the facts. So you got to distinguish between what's reported and then the editorial spin. And also, every reporter goes there with a bias as to, you know, there's millions of facts you could report. What are they reporting? Is that slanted? So you got to all kind of put that in context. And then you got to look for the, you know, alternative sources. You know, a lot of that on the internet. And there you got to be careful, because I see this all the time, and I could go into some of them if you want. There's, you know, Russian narrative talking points that get spun around and then are presented to us as news. I mean, one recent one, I'll just give you one example, is, I'm trying to remember her name, Julia, she was part of the hearings on, you know, the first impeachment. Oh, God, I can't remember her name. Anyway, she had an article in a major publication like Foreign Affairs or The Atlantic, where she said Russia and Ukraine were close to a peace settlement in March, you know, soon after the war started. And then RT, Russia Today, took that and said, yeah, and then, you know, the British and the U.S. Shot down that peace agreement. Now, they base that on the fact that Boris Johnson went over there and told Zelensky not to agree to anything. There's no reporting that Zelensky said, yes, sir. There's no reporting that the U.S. reinforced that message. But it gets spun in this article as if it was the U.S. and the U.K. in this case stopped the peace agreements. But if you were following the news at the time, basically Zelensky said, okay, Ukraine's willing to be not in NATO, have no foreign troops, have no nukes. The latter two things are already in the Ukrainian constitution. And then we'll settle the Donbass and Crimea, which were occupied in part in Donbass and fully in Crimea before the new invasion started February 24th. Zelensky said, we'll deal with that by diplomacy over the next 15 years, not war. And this was agreement. There was another story that said, you know, and this is from Reuters a couple of days ago, said the Russian negotiator took that to Putin, and Putin rejected it. Now, that's new news. But at the time, by early April, there were public statements made by the foreign minister, Lavrov, and by Putin saying, no negotiations. And at that point, their offensive was rolling forward. They were gaining ground. Now, since that time, the Ukrainians, you know, in Kyiv and other parts in the north, pushed the Russians out. And by the time the summer had started, the Russians had lost 17,500 square miles of land to the Ukrainians fighting back. Then you have the summer where you had that war of attrition, the artillery war in the Donbas, and the Russians gained a grand total of 175 square miles. That's 1% of what they lost from March until the summer started. And then, of course, you had this offensive by the Ukrainians in the Kharkiv Oblast, and you know, the numbers are between 2,000 and 3,000 square miles recovered. So now Russia wants, they're saying, we want to negotiate, because they want to freeze the lines where they are and make that the, you know, basically freeze them where they are and have Ukraine accept that, that they're able to take those lands, which are, you know, their access to the Azov Sea and part of the Black Sea and, you know, Mariupol and, you know, right over to Kherson and that other city, I'm forgetting the name of, south of Kherson on the ocean. And the Ukrainians are saying, no, you know, we'll, the last thing I saw from the Ukrainians was we'll negotiate security arrangements once you leave our country. Very different story than what the RT put out. They basically said, you know, Russia has to fight because the Ukrainians took the advice of, you know, the guy, the prime minister of the UK, whose name is blanking me, the guy with the mop head. He's a clown. Anyway, he's out now. So that's just an example. So you got to be careful at the propaganda on both sides. And then, you know, dig into primary sources. When you see a citation, a link, go read it. I mean, another thing, you know, circulating now is that the New York Times said that the Ukrainians admitted that they were shelling the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And that's being cited in a story, you know, that's circulating on, I call him the, after, what's his name, Paul DiMaggio on Counterpunch had an article about the vaudeville left, who are basically making apologies for, you know, the bad things that Putin and the Russians are doing, among other things. And, you know, so that article said, the New York Times said that Ukraine admitted shelling. That's not what the article says. All the article says is that Ukraine wants to regain control of that nuclear power plant. Nothing in there about them saying we were shelling the plant. But that gets twisted in this propaganda to say the New York Times reported that Ukraine admitted to shelling that nuclear power plant, which is kind of ironic because these same kind of sources tend to say, don't trust what the New York Times says, trust us. So anyway, yeah, it's you got to be a critical media reader and, you know, read every side and then check the sources and try to get down to, you know, if you hear a quote. I mean, I'll give you another one. You know, there's a Russian talking point that the U.S. is willing to fight till the last Ukrainian in their war against Russia. That's the way, you know, Putin, Lavrov first put that out. And then, you know, you trace where it came from. There are no American officials that have said that, but in the propaganda, they attribute it to American officials. So, yeah, be careful what you read, double check it, and look for a lot of different sources. It's challenging because public relations, media spin, propaganda is a big industry. Here in the United States, Russia has a big operation. China has an operation. Just about every country with any resources has an operation. So good luck. You really gotta be a critical reader and consumer of broadcast news. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on Graham's abortion ban and the reaction to it? Yeah, so people like Graham were saying, well, if the Supreme Court overrules Roe v. Wade, it'll become an issue in the states. And now he's saying we're going to have a national law banning abortion, like this is Poland, you know, the reactionary government in there got a ban on abortion passed. And the reaction to it, well, I know the Democrats are making hay out of it. And you wonder if, you know, Graham may not be the sharpest knife in the drawer because he just handed the Democrats an issue in which to mobilize people to the polls. Because, you know, I'm in New York State. We've codified Roe v. Wade. We put more money into abortion services since Roe v. Wade was canceled. But this law would override what we're doing. So that's going to mobilize voters in New York, you know, to vote for Democrats who are upholding abortion rights in most cases. So I think that's what the reaction to it. So, you know, I don't know whether Graham is secretly trying to help the Democrats in this election, but I think that's what his proposal does. Vicky Corden, I heard right, CNN is going right wing. Your thoughts? Yeah, the new ownership, I forget who it is, and new management wants more conservative people on air, and they're starting to replace them. I don't have all the details. I've read them. I've just forgot the details as to who's leaving and who's going. But, yeah, and CNN, while it does give you, you know, Democrats and Republicans arguing on there all the time. It used to be where they had crossfire with Pat Buchanan and, you know, some pretty not effective liberals, you know, used to debate stuff. You know, CNN has a tradition of that, and it's kind of irritating because you know what both sides are going to say, and it doesn't really advance the discussion. But they seem to be putting more emphasis on the right now. And, you know, like we were talking about before, you got to read, you know, be a critical media consumer. And, yeah, I think that's where CNN is headed in terms of their front people, you know, the anchors and the commentators. Okay, thoughts on the looming potential strike at UPS? The UPS workers have a lot of issues, and I used to be one, so I know what they're talking about. One is just the heat in which they work in the summer. I mean, a number of UPS drivers died this year from heat stroke, and it's happened in previous summers. This summer was particularly hot in a lot of areas. The hours, you know, the drivers, you know, have to, you know, like 14-hour days, day after day. They're now working on the weekend. They're working 7 days a week because the volume has gone up. They have two tiers among drivers, and that's something really objects to. The older drivers have a better deal than the newer drivers. And then they split the drivers between, they might work half their shift driving and the other half in the hub, you know, unloading or loading packages, which is a physically demanding job. And the way it's been in the past, you kind of move from that into the driver role if that's what you want to do. And so those are some of the issues. And UPS, the Teamster new leadership, had informational leafleting at the sites in August. The contract ends July 31st. So first week of August, they got people aware that this is a year of you know, contract negotiations, and you know, be prepared for a strike. So I can tell you this: the UPS workers went on strike in 1997, and within 2 weeks the company said uncle, and they got a lot of their demands. They got, you know, nice wage increases, better working conditions, better pensions and health care. It was a great contract. And then, you know, all the contract fights I was in after that, we were basically coasting on what we won in 97, because the Jimmy Hoffa regime we were never prepared to strike. You know, to pull off a strike, and I don't know how many UPS Teamsters there are now, I think it's over 200,000. You got to organize. You got to organize for months. So when a strike comes, people know what to expect and what to do. And none of that was done under Hoffa. So the company knew we were never going to go on strike. And so every contract was pretty much all concessions. And that's why, you know, the successors to Hoffa, he was retiring, but the people he endorsed got crushed. in the last election by people who said, that's enough. And now they got to deliver. So, yeah, I think there's a good chance there'll be a strike. But just the threat of a strike, I mean, the thing about companies like UPS, and there are competitors, FedEx, the post office, primarily. But without UPS, a lot of packages won't be delivered. And also, as if a strike looks like it's going to happen, a lot of, you know, people, companies, you know, sending their business are going to switch to FedEx or the post office because they don't want packages they sent through UPS to get stopped because of a strike. In 97, you know, UPS lost temporarily a lot of business. So the workers have a lot of leverage. And the fact that they're preparing for a strike is going to give them a lot of leverage in negotiations. So we should all watch that. Get to know your local UPS Teamsters and, you know, be prepared to come out and help them. You know, the successful strikes, you know, in our age, and this has always been true, is when the workers can bring in the community and support. You know, the classic example is the Chicago teachers, you know, a decade ago. They went out on a strike and, you know, the government, I think it was Rahm Emanuel was still the mayor. In any case, whoever was the mayor, you know, tried to say the workers didn't care about the children, but the workers, the teachers had gone and talked to the parents. And they said, we're striking not just for our own wages and benefits and working conditions. We're striking for the children because we want more money spent. We want to stop these school closures, which have mostly gone happened in the Black community in Chicago. And, you know, was paving the way for charter schools and real estate development where the old schools were. I mean, they had a whole program and they went over to community and that's why they won. So we need the same thing with the Teamsters at UPS. And so, you know, be part of that and, you know, just keep your eye on the news and get to know your local Teamsters and the UPS workers there and be ready to step up because that strike in 97 was the most successful strike from, you know, 1970 until today. Terms of its impact on an industry and on hundreds of thousands of workers. So this is a big deal. And, you know, so let's stay on top of it. In fact, I will be on a podcast about this with some other members of Teamsters for Democratic Union, which I'm still a member of. I'm a retired Teamster, but I belong to that. We're going to talk about the UPS strike. And, you know, pay attention to my Twitter feed or Facebook. We'll get that announced when the time comes, but it's coming up in October. In this case, sponsored by the Socialist Party USA. So yeah, that's going to be a big deal. Keep an eye on that. Andy Messick, 2020 was a tough election year for the Greens, with even Cam Gordon losing re-election. How do you think 2022 and beyond look? And do you think we'll see a few good years soon? Thank you for all you do. Well, thank you for all you do too, Andy. Yeah, 2020, because of Trump, was a tough year. Anybody but Trump. And, you know, people really wanted Trump out of there. So it was really hard in the presidential level. I think Cam Gordon, I mean, he had ranked choice voting. And what happened was, you know, the DSA, Socialist Alternative, that saw his seat as one they could grab. Cam has been in there 2 decades. So, you know, he was weak. I mean, he was vulnerable because, you know, people want change. And so they got, you know, inexperienced, but, you know, at least on paper, progressive or socialist candidate to replace Cam Gordon. I think that was kind of independent of the larger climate of a Republican Party that's become super right-wing, extremist, racist, authoritarian, anti-democratic, which in the presidential election makes people vote for a neoliberal corporate centrist like Biden just to stop Trump, not because they like Biden's program. I think the dynamic in that local election for a district city council seat in Minneapolis was different. It was really, you know, which brand on the left. And, you know, maybe Cam just outwore his shelf life, having been there a long time, you know, been effective. I know the newspapers editorialized after that, you know, the city council is losing someone with a lot of knowledge, experience, and effectiveness. And so anyway, I think that was a different case. Now, I think the larger, process, there might have been a Republican in that race that Cam Gordon was in, but that was a district where it was going to be a progressive. And the question was, which one? Now, in most districts, I'm going to say the larger mentality is among, moderate and more progressive minded people is we got to vote for the Democrats to stop these crazy Republicans. Even though when you get down to the district level, it really doesn't apply because most districts are one party districts. They're a majority Republican or a majority Democrat, and you can vote and vote and vote, and that same Republican or that same Democrat or their replacement is always going to represent that district under single member district winner take all election rules. So what that means is the Greens can be the second party in a lot of those districts because the minor party in those districts often doesn't run seriously. I mean, here in Syracuse, Democrats have all the elected seats. Republicans don't even run against most of them. And when they do, they're not very popular. When the Greens run and there's a Republican and a Democrat, we come in ahead of the Republicans. Same thing can happen in rural districts. The Democrats really don't try. I remember talking to a group of progressives in a county in upstate New York several years ago. And, they liked what I ran on for governor and they wanted me to talk. And I said, well, why don't you all start running as Greens? And they said, we'll never win. And I said, do you ever win as Democrats? And they all laughed and said, no. And I said, well, you might as well run as Greens and not be all caught up. At that time, it was Cuomo corruption. Now we got Governor Hochul, who seems to be even more corrupt than Cuomo. But that's another story. You can ask me about that if you want. So I think at the local level, if we can overcome this larger dynamic of you got to vote Democrat to stop the fascist Republicans and get the, the district dynamics to be the race and the local issues, we can do very well. I mean, over the years, the Greens have elected 1,400 people, over 1,400 races we've won. We currently have about 125 people in local office. At times, we've won a few races for state legislature, and a few Democrats in state legislatures have had it with the corruption in their parties or the right-wing direction, in states like New Jersey and Arkansas. So we can replicate that. Instead of having, 125, we should have thousands. There are 500,000 offices up for election in this country. A lot of them are unopposed. Most of them are local. We should be, Greens should be seeding those offices and creating a bench and a platform for running for state legislature and the House of Representatives. I think if we pursue that strategy, we're going to do better. And the other thing going on is we're winning fights for ranked choice voting. Going into 2020, there were like 20 jurisdictions that had it. Now there's 53 local jurisdictions and two states. And there are more on the polls this November, on the ballot this November for more cities in the state of Nevada. And now the open primary leading to ranked choice voting is another question. I think that's not a good system, but voters are open to this. This is a reform we can win. And what we got to push for is proportional ranked choice voting for legislative bodies. So it's like ranked choice voting for a single seat. You rank your choices as a voter, 1, 2, 3. But you might have 10 seats open with a winning threshold of around 10%. That means the Greens could get, two or three people out of that district in a lot of places. And then we become part of the legislative process, part of the permanent discussion. Gives us much more legitimacy when we get into other elections. And I think over time, we can win a lot of people over because you look at public opinion polling on many of our major issues, Medicare for all, Green New Deal, tax the rich, tuition-free public college, and other issues. And it's 60% and up majorities are with us, not with the Democrats or Republicans. So I think that's the path forward. The question is, will the Greens and the broader left in this country, which is lost in the sauce, as I was saying during the campaign, they're in the Democratic Party. And sure, they've got a few progressives that get a lot of attention, like AOC, but they don't get their way, not in the Democratic caucus, not in the whole Congress. And they actually make the Democrats look better than they are when they are really more than ever controlled from the top down by big money. Meaning we've got to the point where even these, you know, DSA members of Congress and working families back parties, they're getting money from super PACs that are funded, you know, by people that give tens of million dollar contributions. And they, you know, they say, well, I'll take money from corporate PACs, which is easy to say because the corporate PACs can only give a maximum of $5,000. The real money is in these big donations to the super PACs, which are unlimited. And then they don't have to say who gave them money. And then the 501c4s, which is where the dark money goes. They don't have to report their donors. And then they pass that on. They can pass it on to a super PAC or they can directly spend it on a campaign. And it's the progressives are caught up in that now. If you look at the campaign websites of a lot of these progressive Democrats, you'll see a red box. And what that says is, this candidate is a progressive, young person of color, cares about these issues. It's like framing a message. And that's a message to the super PACs. The campaigns are not supposed to communicate with these super PACs, but they do it right on their website with these red boxes. Sometimes they're another color box, but they call it red boxing. I mean, it's a flagrant violation of what is supposed to be a separation of the campaigns from independent expenditures. And they're violating it right in plain sight. So there are a lot of reasons why we need the Green Party. One of them is corruption, not just of the mainstream Democratic Party, but of these progressives. So really it's up to us. And it's a bit of a follow-up, Andy says, do you think nonpartisan elections are a good place for the Green Party to get a seat at the local table? Yes, I mean, most of our wins are local elections. In most of the country, local elections are nonpartisan. Not here in New York. I mean, we elect everything partisan, except for villages. And some school boards, but not my school board here in Syracuse. All seven of them are Democrats. And there you come out. That's where that larger dynamic of you got to vote for the Democrat to stop the crazy Republicans plays less of a role. Although, in fact, nonpartisan is not truth in labeling, particularly in, you know, the bigger cities where they're, you know, party machines. They back their candidates. Everybody really knows who the Democrats and who the Republicans are. But it's not on the ballot. That's why it's nonpartisan. But that's a good place for us to get a start. And it's where we have started. I just say we need to greatly expand on the number of people we have elected so that we're a presence at the grassroots. And then, you know, we're legitimate because we're engaged in local government. And then when one of our people who has that experience wants to run for the state legislature, you know, people say, hey, why not? We've already elected this person. We've seen what they can do. We like what they do. Let's put them in the state legislature or the House of Representatives. You know, that's really the way forward, along with getting these electoral forms. Proportional ranked choice voting is the game changer. Steve Talbot, what does it take to run for an uncontested office as a Green? Are most candidates lawyers and business people? Someone like myself is neither. And I was thinking to start small as a volunteer. Well, what it takes to run technically is usually there's a petition you have to file. In some cases, it's just a filing fee. In some local offices, it's neither. You just tell the Board of Election to put you on the ballot. Depends on local jurisdictions. We have a very decentralized system of ballot access. So you have to find out what's going on in your state and your community. Most candidates are lawyers and business people. That's a problem. They represent the upper middle class and the upper class. And we need all kinds of people in office, particularly working people who are grossly underrepresented. So if you run, you should make that an asset. You know, we're going to put a working person in office who understands what working people are going through. That can be part of the message. And, you know, starting small as a volunteer, yeah, get involved in a campaign, learn how it's done. But, you know, we got, you know, there was news this week, an 18-year-old kid who's a climate activist and resisting the far right book banning and, you know, anti-gay stuff they're doing in the high schools and in the public schools, ran for school board and beat an incumbent who was one of these far right, you know, repressive educators. And in Boise, Idaho, which is, you know, Boise's more cosmopolitan than other parts of Idaho, but still made news because this kid was only 18. He had a few years experience as activism. You know, look up his story. It's the kind of thing that we should be doing as Greens. Now, you ask running as a Green. If it's nonpartisan, you can still run as a Green. You just put on your literature, say you're with the Green Party, and you know what, why you are. And if it's a partisan race, obviously you'll be green on a ballot. In that case, it may require a petition. Or in some cases, I mean, like I said, it varies from state to state. Like in New York, for statewide offices, when the Greens had a ballot line, we just had to have a convention, nominate our candidates, and they went straight to the ballot. Now, if somebody didn't win in the convention, they could also do a petition and force a primary. We've never had that happen. Democrats and Republicans more often do have that happen. But, you know, when we were trying to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days, Governor Hochul didn't have to get a single damn signature. And she had no challengers. Lee Zeldin, the Republican, didn't have to get any signatures. He won his primary. There were three other Republicans that went out and got 15,000 signatures in 42 days, which is the old standard for independent nominating petitions. And they got on the ballot. They had a primary. And Zeldin won, so he's on as a Republican. So, but at the, you know, local and state level, even with a ballot line, the parties have to get a petition. It's 5% of the enrolled voters up to a maximum number. So for Greens, that's usually 5% because there are not that many enrolled Greens. So, you know, like in Onondaga County, well, let's say the congressional district, it would be about 50 signatures of Greens, people enrolled as Greens, which is, you know, take some work because you got to catch them home. And, you know, you, on a good night, you get four or five. So, you know, it might take a couple of weeks to get those signatures, but it's doable. So that's how in New York, for example, you would get on a ballot as a Green. And if it was, you know, for a town or village office, it might just be, you know, three or four signatures. You probably know those Greens and you just have a meeting. Everybody sign a petition. You're on the ballot. So like I said, you got to know what your state laws are and any local, you know, wrinkles in that if you want to run as a Green. Scout Trooper 164, what do you think of Trump and DeSantis having high chances of going to prison? Well, DeSantis, I mean, Trump has got a rap sheet that is, you know, you could take a toilet paper roll and roll it down the street and write in small print all the things he could have been charged on over the years. I mean, all kinds of corporate crime, not paying his workers, tax fraud, insurance fraud, and bank fraud. You know, it's just on and on and on. And then when he became president, he was doing other stuff. And, you know, impeached for it, not convicted, because the Senate was looking at the partisan politics, not the facts of the case. And now what we've seen revealed, like with these classified documents he took down to him to his golf resort in Florida and was scattered around, it's hard to see how the Justice Department does not indict him. Although, you know, the latest thing is Trump-appointed judge said you got to get a master and you can't do any more investigation of those documents till the master has gone through them, which is going to delay stuff for a while, although the Justice Department's appealing. I think they're going after Trump. And I just got to believe it. In the end, this guy is going to get caught. We followed him here in New York since the late 70s. I remember when Joe Connison, late, you know, journalist at the Village Voice, came out with this thing about this guy, Donald Trump, who was coming in with his daddy's money from Queens to do real estate in New York. And I was repelled at this guy from the beginning. He was, you know, arrogant, full of himself, had no sense of, it's all about money and his status, not about, you know, building a better New York from a community design or urban design point of view. And then, you know, soon we started hearing about, you know, shady deals. Then he bought those casinos and he went bankrupt owning casinos. That's hard to do. And what he was doing was pulling money out for himself. So anyway, this guy is just, you know, he had Roy Cohn, the old lawyer for Joe McCarthy, and then the mob as his favorite lawyer. Just really, you know, really a mafioso kind of guy. Although he kind of was arm length from the actual mob, he was doing business with him. Just unbelievable. DeSantis, I don't know what he's done criminal, although some of what he's done to these immigrants, you know, flying them or bussing them off to other states may violate some statute. I don't know. But I can certainly say from what I've seen, it's immoral, if not illegal. And the problem is, if he's the Republican candidate for president and he wins, he's going to be more dangerous than Trump because he's more competent. Trump is lazy. He's ignorant. He doesn't stay on top of things. He wants sycophants, not effective people working in his administration. I'm afraid DeSantis will be a lot more effective than Trump. So that's a problem. Question via email. Thoughts on Republican governors sending people to liberal states against their will? They should face legal consequences for essentially human trafficking. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's legal under human trafficking statutes, but if it is, yeah, I mean, they should be brought up on charges. What they're doing is certainly wrong, particularly when people are being sent against their will. But what I've, you know, from what reporting I've heard, the people working for, you know, the governor in Texas, the governor of Florida, entice these people with promises they have no intention of keeping. Like, you know, we're gonna send you where you can get a job, and you're gonna get, you know, a credit card with cash balance on it, so you can get started where we're taking you, and none of that comes true. So, yeah, it's a dirty business. They're using these people as pawns for political purposes, and it's disgusting. Scout Trooper 164, how do you think the Ukrainian-Russian war will play out? Well, it's hard to predict. The one thing I do know is I don't know. You know, I've talked a lot with Matthew Ho, the other former Marine that's run for office for the Green Party, and everybody knows his experience, combat veteran, and he's working with the State Department and resigned when Obama surged in Afghanistan because he knew from being on the ground that, you know, we didn't know what the hell we were doing or who we were dealing with in Afghanistan, and it was just going to be counterproductive and create more terrorists than we were trying to fight. So, and what Matthew has said about this war is the one thing we know is we can't predict. You know, it could go any way. You know, how far is Putin and the Russian regime willing to go? I mean, they lost 2,000 or 3,000 square miles in this offensive that the Ukrainians had in Kharkiv. And most of the reporting is the Russian forces there basically ran. They didn't want to fight. A lot of them appeared to be draftees, people just, you know, the Russians are now pulling people out of prisons as a, you know, if you survive 6 months, you'll be free. That's the promise. And they just ran. So, you know, we didn't know that ahead of time. And now they, you know, that offensive hit a natural barrier, this river. So there's another sliver of Kharkiv they're going to try to take back, but may not go so fast as the Russians reinforced that. So, you know, you hear a lot from the sort of the Putinist left here that, oh, the Ukrainians can't win the war, so they better surrender now or they're going to even get more land taken from them and more of them killed. And, but, you know, this belies I think I earlier in this podcast said, you know, they already lost 17,500 square miles from March 21st, the peak of the Russian advancement, to the fight in the Donbass this summer. Russians gained back a little bit, but now they've lost more. So who says the Ukrainians can't win? On the other hand, the response of the Russians to the offensive in Kharkiv was war crimes, attacking infrastructure, power plants in Kharkiv, a dam in the city where actually Zelensky grew up. And I can't remember the pronunciation of that city, but it's in south central, sort of southeast central Ukraine. Destroying infrastructure is a war crime. How much further, you know, is Russia willing to go? They may not have, you know, a lot of reporting that Russian troops are demoralized. What's their motivation? Money. Ukrainians' motivation is, you know, their land, their families, their existence. So, you know, they have a lot more to fight for, but they have less resources. NATO is providing them with weapons, but you talk to Ukrainians, they wonder, you know, they feel like NATO's just giving them enough to stop the Russians, not go on the offensive against them. And in Russia, you know, they've got a lot of, you know, air power and missiles, and they can strike, you know, as, and then if you follow Russian state media or the people that do, and I heard a program, it was frightening just to listen to these warmongers on Russian state TV saying, you know, we need to take the gloves off and, you know, bomb them back to the Stone Age, make them, you know, go without electricity all winter, force 20 million of them to become refugees in Western Europe. That's what they're saying on Russian state media. And apparently the hawks in Russia, Putin realized that if he does have a full mobilization and goes from so-called special military operation to full-scale war, he may get a lot of resistance from within Russia. I mean, you may know or may not know that there's a group called the Anarcho-Communist Combat Group. And they take credit for derailing military trains, setting recruitment officers on fire. There is that kind of resistance in Russia. We know of thousands of people in prison. We had a bunch of municipal councilors in some cities, including St. Petersburg, where Putin is from. You know, basically say Putin should resign. Some of them said he was treasonous for starting this war. I mean, there's starting to be resistance within Russia. I'm just laying out all the factors. I can't predict, except I know the Ukrainians will fight, you know, for their country. And Russia is doesn't seem to have any scruples about what it might do. So it's not a good situation. So that's the best I can tell you. I can't really predict. It could go either way, or it could be, you know, a long drawn out thing until the sides are exhausted and they come to the table and hammer out some kind of agreement. Scout Trooper 164, will the war in Ukraine cause any public loss for Putin or harm his chances of getting elected? Look, the next election, he's going to win because he's going to fix the election. We have enormous amounts of evidence that, because they have electronic voting. And there were a bunch of independent socialists who used the Communist Party line in certain districts where they could get it to run, you know, a left-wing campaign. And they won in some cases, including in St. Petersburg. At least they won on election day. And then when the authorities counted the electronic vote, which you can't, you know, audit, suddenly they lost. This was last, I think it was last September, or maybe last August, and then a year ago. So then one of these communist dissidents called a demonstration in front of the Duma, their parliament, because they can't have street demonstrations like that, but a member of the Duma can have a public meeting in front of the Duma. So that was what they did. And then they vowed to go to court. Well, they didn't get anywhere in court. And that member of the Duma, the dissident communist, ended up being arrested for having a elk that was poached, supposedly, in the back of his car. And so now he's out of the Duma and serving a sentence. So That's how they deal. They're not free and fair elections. So if Putin runs again, he's going to win just because they're going to fix it. But public loss, I mean, if people won't fight for him, like the American army wouldn't fight in Vietnam. That's why Nixon had the Vietnamese war. After Tet, more and more units in the army, even some in the Marine Corps, were saying no. When they were told to go out in the field and do some mission, they said, no, we're staying out of trouble. We're staying right here. To the point of sometimes killing their officer, that second lieutenant or the captain, if it was a larger group that was telling them to go out on that mission and wouldn't listen to the soldiers. They had arms too, and they used them. If that kind of thing happens in the Russian military, which there's some indications, you know, like what just happened in Kharkiv may be happening, the army could collapse. And then, you know, that probably politically will be the end for Putin, because the other members of the ruling elite, they call them the Soloviki. They're the KGB, former KGB types. That's his inner circle. And then they have oligarchs that have agreed to work with them, who control the economy or major parts of it. But there seems to be dissent there. I mean, some of these oligarchs are dropping like flies, those that express dissent overseas. You know, they're falling out of windows, it seems, from the seventh floor in different parts of the world. So there's a lot going on there. It's hard to know. So the question, will the war cause any public loss for Putin? I think there's a chance it will, because I think the indication of that is he won't call for a general mobilization, basically a draft, because I think he's afraid what the reaction will be of the people. And, you know, I've read left-wing sociologists in Russia, or now in exile, who say about 20% of the people are enthusiastic for the war, about 20% are anti-war, and the other 60% don't want to hear about it. They just want to go about their lives. They don't want to be bothered. They want to keep their head low. But if Putin calls a draft, it's where those people go that may be a problem. So, yeah, I think there's a chance this war is going to be something Putin wished he hadn't initiated. Steve Talbot, if Putin is ousted from power, will it be new boss, same as the old boss situation? Would the oligarchs just pick another stand-in? I don't think the oligarchs are really the people choosing. It's the old KGB guys, the Soloviki. That is the hardcore rulers, and they got control of their secret police and intelligence services. That's really the core of the power. Now, the military is broader, and they may be unhappy at what they were put into in Ukraine. They could become a player. So I think it's hard to tell. I mean, the country could, you know, fall apart. There's a lot of, you know, Lenin called Russia the prison house of nations. There's still a lot of nations that wanted to go independent after the Soviet Union fell apart and were not able to. And there's still a lot of that sentiment. So, you know, it could fracture along those lines. It could fracture between different armed factions and the military and intelligence. And that's a scary situation because, you know, the nukes are located in different parts of Russia or the Russian Federation, you know, and you know, they could be standing off against each other in a fight with both sides having nukes. The left is just not organized. The Russian Socialist Movement, which was one of the better groups, almost all of them, at least their intellectual core, has gone into exile. There are a couple of socialists still commentating from Russia, Boris Kargolitsky, Greg Yudin. They have positions in the university, but Kargolitsky's optimistic. He thinks this will open things up for a progressive change. I hope he's right, but it's really hard to tell. Via email, thoughts on Republican... Whoops, that disappeared. Thoughts on... Oh, that maybe is what I asked before. Maybe that got pulled down because our hour is up. So I'm going to go with that assumption. And, you know, thanks for tuning in. I'm going to have some guests coming up. One of them I briefly introduced to you last week. That's Dr. Claire Cohen, a Green from Pittsburgh, who's big on having a publicly owned national healthcare service. which is what we campaign on, not just single payer socialized insurance, but socializing and democratizing the whole healthcare system, which we really need now that, you know, Wall Street has basically taken over the hospitals and the delivery system. So she's going to be on October 1st. I'm planning to have Yulia Yurchenko back just to take apart some of these Russian tropes that so much of the left and the peace movement in this country is, you know, taking as their starting points, their assumptions, which are wrong because they don't know, you know, Ukraine and what's really going on. And especially from the viewpoint of the left, which Yulia is part of, what's called the social movement, a socialist group in Ukraine. And there's some local candidates I hope to have on. And I'm just waiting to nail down Yulia's next appearance. So then I can, I'm keeping the dates open for her because she's got a very busy schedule. Right? She's in a bunch of conferences all over Europe about this Ukraine situation, really through the end of the month. So anyway, that's what's coming up. And meanwhile, you know, don't be discouraged. You know, the Build Back Badly wasn't adequate for health, for the climate issue. The whole care economy stuff that was in Build Back Better didn't go anywhere. All we're getting is more subsidies for privatized Obamacare for the most part. And so we got a lot of work to do. But, you know, as I discussed when asked about, you know, what are our electoral prospects? We can make advances at the local level. We can make advances on election reforms. We are. And Greens need to be in the middle of that. So, you know, I'm just saying, don't get discouraged. Keep fighting. And, you know, social movements aren't gradual accretions of little reforms. They explode and we make leaps. It takes movements like the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Liberation Movement to get to civil rights, voting rights, and at least token anti-poverty initiatives we got in the 60s. Same thing with, you know, the labor movement. It was flat on its back in the 20s. It took like 3 years after the Depression started before, you know, the CIO and industrial unionizing exploded. Or take Occupy, which didn't lead to any lasting change, but it took that from 2008 when the financial collapse happened until 2011. 3 years before it exploded. And it exploded like who would have known the murder of George Floyd would produce some of the largest demonstrations. The common thing about Occupy and George Floyd was police brutality. You know, yes, there was some stuff at Wall Street that had been called by, what's that group called up in Canada? They criticize ads. I forget the name. And I was part of a call to show up about 2 weeks later at Freedom Square in Washington. And we were trying to, that was the year the budget year started. It was the anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. And we were taking our cue from the Freedom Square demonstrations of the Arab Spring. And Occupy Wall Street beat us to it, changed the politics a little bit. You know, they were targeting banks and not the government, who actually has the power to, you know, regulate or take over the banks. But what got that, what made that thing grow was they kettled those young women and then the cops kettled those young women and then sprayed them with pepper spray. That went viral and a lot of people got angry. And that's, and then they realized what Occupy Wall Street was about and it exploded across the country. So what I'm saying is we don't know when the next explosion is coming. So we just got to keep plugging away and be ready for when it does happen. And that means being organized and ready to take people in when they're ready. So good luck this week. We'll see you next week and take care.